get to Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Herbert Douglas Jr. was a 14-year-old living in Hazelwood when he followed the exploits of American track and field star Jesse Owens in the Berlin Olympics of 1936. Mr. Owens would go on to win 4 gold medals, and Mr. Douglas was so inspired that after graduating from Alderdice High School and the University of Pittsburgh, he became an Olympian himself, winning a bronze medal in the long jump at the 1948 London Games. Today, at the age of 94, he is the oldest living African-American Olympian, and tonight he joins 5 fellow Black Olympians for Breaking Barriers, an evening with Olympic greats at the Heinz History Center. He's with us now in studio. Herb Douglas, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. How
Thanks,
are you?
Thanks, Paul. It's a pleasure to be back home.
It's a pleasure to have you here. You do not look 94. I mean, you could easily, and this is not anywhere close to an exaggeration, you could easily pass for, you know, 49. What do you do to stay in such great shape? Are you still active? Are you still playing sports?
Yeah, I still eat at McDonald's. I go to KFC. I keep. But I exercise. I was just telling Ann that I've been exercising all my life. My entire life I've done something. And today I swim every other day a quarter of a mile. Now, I miss it sometime, but I don't... I actually believe that that has kept me free from disease. But I have good genetics, too. My dad lived to be 20 days less than 92. But at 41 years old, he became sightless. And he was fortunate enough in 1930 to get a seeing eye dog, and he walked with a seeing eye dog for 46 years. My mother, I'm still trying to catch her. She was 96 when she passed. So genetically, and they say that's 30% of your longevity. But I actually believe because I exercised and my dad exercised because he walked up and down Hazelwood Avenue. If you've ever been there, that's like going up to Pikes Peak.
A lot of Pittsburgh is that way, isn't it?
It really is. That's so true. Yeah, it's a great city. I've seen the transition from the steel mills being demolished to the beautiful views that I never saw growing up because of the smog. You couldn't see because of fog and the soot from the smokestacks, and it's a beautiful city. Well, I've been away from here 65 years.
Yeah, you went over to Philly, which I really wasn't going to maybe make a big deal out of that, but yeah. Why aren't you living here, Herb?
Well, because I couldn't get a job when I graduated.
Oh.
So I had to go to Atlanta to get a job, and I worked all the southeastern states for a company named Pabst Brewing Company. And then I wanted to get closer to Hazelwood, so I moved to Philadelphia. And today, I still live near Philadelphia. I live in Philadelphia today in a condominium.
Okay, but you still root for the Pittsburgh teams, I hope?
Oh, yeah. Franco Harris is one of my best friends, and you know I root for Pitt. I'm on the board of trustee, emeritus now, but I was on the board of trustee for several years.
Hail to Pitt. We are talking with Herb Douglas Jr. You can join the conversation with a comment or question for Herb at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Let's go back to August of 1936. You are a 14-year-old living in Hazelwood. There's no television then, but you are aware of the history being made by Jesse Owens at the Olympics in Berlin. Tell us how you were following his exploits.
Well, 1936... Jesse Owens, he accomplished something second to none. In 1935, he electrified the world by winning four races and one long jump, and he established 3 world records and tied one. That's when I first knew about Jesse Owens when he was at Ohio State. The next year, he won 4 gold medals. 2 Olympic records, And please believe me, he didn't win the Sullivan Award. And I was cognizant of that. And that always was in the back of my mind.
That's the award that goes to the best
amateur athlete. Yeah, that's true. And he was speaking for Alfred Landon at Watt Street School, which is Albert Vann now. It's an elementary school on Watt Street. My mother took me over there to listen to him campaign speech for Alfred Landon. And as he was going out the door, he put his arms around my shoulder and walked with me, and I'm this young kid. And I told him immediately, I run the 100. I'm the city champ in junior high. And I jump, and I told him what I did. And he said, "That's wonderful. You did better than I did." And I didn't know he was lying through his teeth, but he actually was. And so when I met him in life, I used to bring that up.
And those city meets, were they held at Pitt Stadium then?
The high school meets? Yeah. And at Colfax, when I was in the fourth grade, they used to have a city meet for elementary school students. And we gathered by and would be in certain classes by weight and age. And I won. I recall my mother sitting in the stands with an umbrella. It was hot. In the fifth grade, the doctor said I had a heart murmur. The sixth grade, I won again. The seventh grade, I went to Gladstone Junior High School, and I didn't do too well. But the eighth grade and the ninth grade, I won the 75-yard dash in the eighth grade and the 100-yard dash in the ninth grade. Then I moved to Alderdice. And in moving to Alderdice in the 10th grade, I didn't do too well. I had a back problem or something. But in the 11th grade, I won 100, 220 in the broad jump like Jesse Owens in the city. And in the 12th grade, I won the 100, 220, and the broad jump, not only in the city, but the state, too.
So what were the opportunities like for a black kid growing up in Pittsburgh who wanted to be an elite track and field athlete? Obviously, you were setting goals for yourself. At what point did you realize, you know, or maybe somebody told you, you have a shot at being an Olympian?
I was always told that in high school, in Alderdice. Mm. They always thought that I'd make the Olympic team. And then during that time when I was in, there were no African Americans in baseball professionally, basketball professionally, or football. So we had no goals. We had no one to idolize. But we did have the Olympic Games, and Jesse Owens competed. And along with Jesse Owens, which you'd never hear much about, there were four other African Americans who won gold medals. That was a total of 8 gold medals in track and field on the 1936 Berlin Olympic Games, 8 out of the total 15 that the United States won. Now you heard about Jesse Owens, which is true because he was the icon. But we had Woodruff right here in our backyard. We had Archibald Williams on the West Coast in the 400 meters. We had Cornelius Johnson in the high jump, who won a gold medal. And also Ralph Metcalf on the 4x1 relay team. That was a total of 8 medals with Jesse. And that's when we thought that that was the Renaissance period for the African-American in sport. And 50 years ago, I thought about it. And 3 years ago, we started on a film, which we're going to show tonight, of these 8 athletes, 9 total members on that team that won medals.
Yeah, that particular film is called The Renaissance Period of the African American in Sports. It's a half an hour documentary co-produced by our guest, Herb Douglas Jr., and it focuses on the 36 Olympics, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. But I wanted to go back to your exploits at Alderdice. You were someone that, as you just said, was being encouraged to think about the Olympics. But unfortunately, as you were graduating high school, World War II had broken out. Not sure if Pearl Harbor had happened by that time, but Europe was at war, and so there were not going to be Olympic Games, and as it turned out, they didn't happen again until you ended up participating in 1948. How did you keep your dream alive, not knowing exactly when there was or if there was going to be another Olympics?
Well, when you grow up and you incorporate in your prayers at a young age of 14, and incorporating in my prayers, I said, I hope one day I'll make the Olympic team like Jesse Owens. It was so ingrained in me, and when I made the Olympic team at the age of 26, I went on, and sometimes I would incorporate that in my prayers after the Olympic game. But that was 12. It was a 12-year hiatus, and that was what we had to look forward to, the Olympic Games, if you want to be the great athlete for the world. And I kept my focus, and it just happened to. I was able to sustain it.
So talk about the process that you went through of becoming an Olympian. And by the way, if you're just tuning in, it's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Herb Douglas Jr., and he is the oldest living African-American Olympian and a 1948 London Olympics bronze medalist. He won in the long jump. And the process of becoming an Olympian is a difficult one. There's all sorts of trials that you have to go through. How did you end up making the team?
Training and hard work. My dad taught me how to work hard by giving me a job in his garage on Ellsworth Avenue. At 8 at night, I started, and 8 in the morning, I ended. In the armory that's nearby Ellsworth Avenue and College Avenue, I worked out there after I'd worked all night.
After your 12-hour
yes,
shift.
Indeed. And I would work and then go home and sleep. Now, that wasn't conducive for a young married man. I married at 19. but I was so focused that I even trained after working all night for 3 years. And my dad had me, because he was sightless and couldn't get adequate help, they had to take defense jobs during that period. So that's what you do. When I met Mandela, I asked him, I said, how could you be incarcerated for 27 years and come out and adjust to society? And what I was really telling him, how could you adjust and accept people the way they are? And he said, Herbert, you do what you have to do. And that's what I learned from Mandela. And, you know, he was a few years older than me.
Well, it's things have changed for elite athletes. Now you can receive money. Yeah, you're rubbing your thumb and forefinger together to indicate money. You can be paid to train. And in the days that you were competing, you had to be strictly an amateur. And a guy like Jim Thorpe, maybe the greatest Olympian ever, couldn't be paid $5 to play semi-pro baseball, or
that's so true,
or would be otherwise ineligible. So, what did you do to train? I mean, did you have help, or was it just all on your own? Did you have a coach?
Well, when I worked with my dad, no, I didn't have a coach. But I was given a good foundation by Ralph Metcalf. Ralph Metcalf played second in the 1932. Los Angeles Olympic Games in the 100 meters and came back and placed second to Jesse Owens. So I knew he knew a lot about track and field. So I went to Xavier where he was teaching. And then when the war broke out, I had to go and help my father. But had the war not come along, I would have been a sprinter because Metcalf was training me. And the only reason I went to Pitt was to get an education. So I walked down, because my dad's business was on Ellsworth Avenue, and I walked down there after Jimmy Joe was accepted the first, and I asked Clark Shaughnessy, could I go out for the football team? And he said, well, you're a good long jumper, because I'd won the national AAU at that year. And he said, I'll give you some shoes tomorrow. And that's how I got into Pitt. I got in there on a football scholarship.
What was the atmosphere like when you finally made it to the Olympics in London? It had to be pretty festive because England had just come through the war and there hadn't been an Olympics for 12 years. So people had to be pretty excited that it was finally happening again.
1948, London was still in the ruins of the war. The buildings were shattered and what have you. And like kids today, Gabby Douglas tells me where she lives and all that, and where I live when I was in the 1948 Olympic Games was in the England's barracks, and they had barracks,
an army barracks.
Yeah, and I had to stay there, and they put all of us African Americans in one Quonset. And we bounced off of one another and said, we're not going to leave here unless all of us win a medal. So, and that's what they did with Mandela. They put all the civil rights activists in one cell block, and they bounced off of one another, and that was like a university. Well, we bounced off of one another, and all of us came back with a medal.
There was a symmetry, an energy that you were all feeding off of?
That's true, yeah. And one of them will be here tonight. Harrison Dillard, who did it. He had an accomplishment that never had been done before. He won the 100 meters in 1948, and he came back in 1952 and won the high hurdles. No one has ever done that in the history of track and field. He'll be here tonight, and we're like brothers now.
How did you end up winning your bronze medal in the long jump?
Well, I was going to be up on that podium if I had to do a backflip and a headstand, because the day before practicing, I twisted my ankle. And I didn't want to march in the opening day ceremonies. And I remember being interviewed, and they said, well, you're going to compete tomorrow. I said, I'll compete if I have to break my leg. I'm going to jump, and hopefully that I'll land up on a podium. And God bless me, and I did.
So what did you do? Was your ankle?
I twisted my ankle.
Did you tape it?
Oh, yeah, they taped it. I could feel it. But it's not like today. They can break a leg and go out the next day and play football. I don't know how they do it, but we didn't have that. You youngsters have really increased in medicine, communication, and everything else.
You later went on to mentor Olympians like Edwin Moses and Roger Kingdom. What advice did you give them?
Edwin Moses, when he won the Olympic Games, he didn't want to go back to Atlanta to be a part of a parade. And he was intimidating at that time. He had his dark glasses. He had the beard at that time. He had the bush. And I said, now, you're going to have to start cleaning more for the corporate world, because I was in the corporate world.
How did he react to that?
Well, he was 21, so he did listen to me. He marched in the parade because going to Morehouse, he didn't get the profile of a high jumper that went to Georgia Tech. So he was very irate about that, and I didn't blame him. But I said, Maynard Jackson is the mayor. You got to go back. You got to march in that. Today, all these years later, we talk, I guess, once a month. And he's well-established. He was smart to begin with. He had an IQ nearly 150. So he could have done anything he wanted. In fact, I advised him to go into med school, but he was still in his glory years, and he wanted to run, so that he did.
We have to get to a break, but before we, and then bring in Ann Mataraz, and we'll have you stay with us, Herb. But before we wrap up this segment, the Summer Olympics in Brazil are coming in less than 3 weeks, and some elite athletes are avoiding the games because of concerns over the Zika virus, among other things. If you were in your athletic prime today and you had made the Olympic team, qualified for the team, would something like Zika make you consider staying away?
Not at that time. Today, yes. I've been to 13 Olympic games since 1948, and I'm not going to this one. because at the age of 94, I may stumble and fall, and they'll put me in one of those hospitals down there, and I may not make it out. But no, I wouldn't take the chance today. But when you're young like that.
As an athlete,
yeah, I'd go. I'd go to number one, represent my country. And because what dominates today is finance. And I perhaps would have made money.
And perhaps. I think it's pretty safe to say that that you would have. 94-year-old Herb Douglas, the oldest living African-American Olympian, a bronze medalist at the 1948 London Games, is our guest. He's going to stay with us. And we are also going to talk more about tonight's evening of Olympic greats at the Heinz History Center with Ann Mataraz. That's coming up. Stay tuned. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.